It's December 26th, 2009, 10:06 a.m. on the central coast of California. Today on Geek Speak, a truncated version, unfortunately. We didn't get the show recorded. Bummer. Three different formats. We recorded with the station system. Unfortunately, it was rebooted during the show, and therefore we only have the second half on that. We recorded on a CD that never finalized, an audio recording deck that never finalized. Really interesting stuff. I tried recovering that. So I do technically have the show on a unformatted, well, if you want to play with the CD and see if you can recover the show, that'd be great. Let me know. And we have a recording on my laptop, which the input levels are way too high, and Ben's not a part of it because he joined us via Skype, so it's a pretty horrible truncated thing. So in any case, the show will only be a half an hour long, just the second half of the show. Miles and Ben and myself did the show. We don't have a theme song for this week because, of course, therefore, because of the, you know, we didn't get it recorded, but we could play that now, except that I can't because of the copyright issues with the theme song, and that's been an ongoing issue with the Geek Speak show, that we have this great theme song by Devo, Through Being Cool. We've been playing it for years. We put that on air, and because of our NPR affiliations, we're able to reuse that audio in our podcast, but we can't make the podcast Creative Commons. We can't take the podcast and say, hey, anybody can use this anytime they want, the Creative Commons rules, if you're interested, creativecommons.org. We want to do that. So I'm going to stop using the theme song Through Being Cool, even though I love it. I'm going to start playing something new for next year, 2010, next week's show. So, new theme song. If you want to hear Through Being Cool, just listen to our last 9 years of Geek Speak on the website. This week's show is truncated, only the second half of it. It was a fun show, and I wish I could share all of it with you. Unfortunately, I can't. If you are interested in trying to recover a CD and really know how to do that, basically, there was two sessions. The first session was closed, the audio track. Second session wasn't. The entire disc was finalized. No idea if it's possible. Well, I know it's possible, but no idea if it's viable to get that data off. So thanks for listening to Geek Speak. Here's the truncated show for 2009, December 26th.
Done specifically by cell phones as a causal link, that ends up being a pretty high bar. So really, you have to look at the folks that say cell phones do cause cancer, and then try to find some correlation. And that's, I think, what I was trying to come up with regard to that study, to say, yes, when we look at cancer rates, that there is a correlation with the with brain tumor increases with the amount of cell phone use.
Right.
And one of the comments made was that someone had a friend who died of brain cancer recently, and I was really sorry to hear that. At the same time, I had a friend who in her teenage years had a brain tumor, and she had never owned a cell phone, and she had, and her family had never owned a cell phone. No one ever had, because this was the early 90s and they weren't in common everyday use yet, at least by the middle class. And the idea is that cancers happen. So it's not just a brain cancer showed up. You can't make that association.
Right.
Unless you already have that confirmation bias in your head saying, I have a transmitter next to my head. That should cause cancer. Therefore, every time I see someone that has a brain cancer and they use a cell phone, I'm going to associate it in my head.
That's the bias, that you already assume that it's going to do it. And therefore, when you hear stories that support your bias, you hear it. When you hear stories that conflict with your predetermined bias, you don't pay attention as much to that bias.
Right.
That's the way humans work, one of the psychoses of our species. The thing is, as a electrical, I have an electronics degree, and I actually understand, and as you do, Miles, that the radiation type that comes out of that shouldn't affect tissue. That's one of the things about...
At most, it would be a slight heating, and when we say a slight, I mean like 1 or 2 degrees.
The
sun is going to have so much of a bigger impact upon the temperature.
Right.
Of you.
Well, that's true, but one could argue that a cell phone would maybe heat up tissue that's inside of your head, whereas the sun would only heat up tissue that, I mean, we're not doctors, though.
If we're talking about a couple degrees, I mean, it's...
That's the thing, unless, is it doesn't... Yeah. The heating up issue is not... Like, the heating up of the phone, the battery actually being expelled and putting it into your head, that's a lot more heat production than we're talking about. We're talking about very little amount of energy gets translated into the water molecules and warms them.
Right.
It's not, you're getting radiated much more than that by this kind of radiation. It's just,
you're
not
getting radiated a lot
radiation.
More by the blood that's circulating that heat away.
That's
from
right.
Your brain.
I mean, the body handles heat. It's not, that's not an issue. And we're not talking about ionized radiation. That's the thing that people get a lot of scaredness, is that it doesn't have the impact level, doesn't have the radiation level to throw electrons off of their space, right? So it's not
to break DNA chains, yeah, which is really the, where mutation is coming from.
Where cancer comes from at some level. So that's why it does, even though, so my confirmation bias is, well, that doesn't make, my confirmation bias would exist as well, or my bias, I should say, would exist as well, as I'd say, well, it doesn't make any sense that that could, there's any mechanism to do that. So that doesn't make any sense to me. So when I hear there's a story about a person with a phone and cancer, I go, well, that, I ignore it. Right? I pay more attention to the people that don't. So we all have these biases, which are very strange. Now, that's why you take a giant sampling and you see what happens.
Right. This is why, we have the scientific method, is humans have bias. All humans have bias. And that's the dilemma. So how do we find a way to be as objective as possible as human beings? And that's what the scientific method is a way to reduce bias. And you do that by gathering data and then taking a look at that data and then making predictions based upon that data.
Right, right. So Ben, you found a study that kind of seemed to conflict with Miles' study, and do you want to talk more about that?
I'm not prepared to talk about it.
Oh,
because
I'm sorry.
I don't have it up. But yeah, basically, just it was a, what's it called, a meta-analysis.
It was a meta-analysis.
Basically, they looked at 9 or 13 or some large number of studies that have been done over the past. And their conclusion by looking at all of those studies was that there was sufficient epidemiological evidence to conclude that there is some correlation between cell phone use and brain cancer, which basically said exactly the opposite of what
right.
Miles
the,
is.
Yeah, the issue that I had with that study was that it wasn't actually gathering data on its own. It was sampling other studies.
And assuming that other studies are good scientific studies with large pools, that's a great way to determine if there's a thing going on. It's a great way to say, should we study this more, for example.
Right, but I couldn't find any information on the size of the data pool.
That's the big thing, is that we don't know what studies those were. So let's say they were not very good studies. Then you're basically taking a whole bunch of bad stuff and putting it together and saying, yay, it works now. You know, a whole bunch, a plural of anecdote, for example. we'll go a different way. But just because you have lots of studies, if they're really badly designed and they all come to the same conclusion, that's a bad conclusion. Then you look at a lot of them together, you're still going to have bad conclusions. So that's the question about that study. And of course, we don't know much about it. You read a bit of the article, Miles, and couldn't find any numbers about what they were
doing. Yeah, I couldn't find the sampling size. They did have some good stuff, like that you only use studies that are at least 10 years old because the cancer is going to take a while to show up. Things like that. But I looked for anything having to do with how many people, what the sampling size was, how many people they were working with. And were you able to find that, Ben?
No, unfortunately, I don't have access to the university library, so I can't get to or any of those.
You have to come and visit me at work.
I don't have access to the study. So.
All right, let's move on.
You also have to log in, too.
Yeah, let's move on a bit on the show. I just want to mention that we are not taking calls today. Rick's on vacation with his family, so we're not taking calls. You're welcome to send us email if you'd like, though we probably won't look at it during the show. But we do look at our email throughout the week, and sometimes we respond. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. My name's Lyle Troxell. The geeks this morning are Miles Elam and Ben Jaffe. And I mentioned that, so we can go on with more news, I believe. Yeah, let's do that. Actually, I've got a story that I want to talk about that I didn't know much about this until a couple weeks ago. And it's Benford's Law, named after a Benford, of course. And it's basically, it's a very complicated thing to say, but what I'll just say is this. When you're looking at random numbers, the first digit of random number sets, no, I shouldn't say random number sets, naturally occurring numbers. So if you go and you find a whole bunch of different species of animals on an island, and you measure all their lengths, and you collect all the data, you measure all their lengths, and then you put it in a database, you'll find that the first digit is most of the time, or more than any other number by itself, is 1. It's 30% the chance is the first digit is 1. And the reason this is occurring is because of the logarithmic scale, that in nature, most things fill into a pattern of logarithmic, rather than what we think of as our decimals, our normal
linear
scale. Linear. And here's an example of how it's a different way of thinking about numbers. Nature does numbers a little differently than the way we kind of have been forced to think about numbers in school and such. And that is this kind of thing. If you look at Miles and I are talking, we say, what's the difference between 9 and 10? We say 1. Okay, cool. So what's the difference between 1 and 2? 1. We think, oh, the differences between those numbers are the same. Well, they're not the same. 1 to 2 is a doubling of the size of the number, right? 1 gets twice as big to get to 2. 9 to 10 just
about 11%. Yeah.
It's only 11% change increase. So if in a sense of what's more a change or how much more different are they, the 1 and the 2 are a lot more different than 9 and 10. So I can do that again if it was confusing. 1 to 2 is one number difference, and 9 to 10 is one number difference. But 1 to 2 is doubling the size of the number, and 9 to 10 is only, as Miles says, 11% increase of the number.
Yeah, so you're thinking of it multiplicatively instead of additively, if those are words.
Kind of. The one way to think about this is that if you look at that scale in a logarithmic way, where that's the terminology instead of linear, you see, and if you scale that, you'll see that between 1 and 2 is a large part of the difference, if you will, of the numbers. Is that a good way to explain logarithmic scale?
Sure.
I think that makes sense. So Benford's law is basically saying, look, if you take a whole bunch of numbers and you throw them down and they run across the logarithmic pattern, or they run across just kind of randomness, but you're throwing it against the logarithmic number system, most of the time, a third of the time, I should say, the numbers fall in that one area, which means their first digit would be 1. And so as you... So that's kind of a good way to talk about it. At least you understand the issue at hand, that if I take a whole bunch of numbers in the world that are created naturally, if you will, and I concatenate them together, I'll see this pattern where a third of them are at in 1, and 9 is something like really low frequency rate. I'm not sure. 1 in 20 times 9 shows up as the first digit.
It's kind of like if you think of people's height would be a good measure of this, to say how many people are 2 feet tall.
Mm-hmm.
That's on one end of the scale. And maybe one person.
Okay.
You know, or maybe 18 inches tall. You know, one person in the world, the
right.
smallest person. And then you think, who is 8.5 feet tall?
Okay.
And you'll have a small number of people again. That's that one that you
and
have
on your
side.
You're describing the bell curve kind of thing.
Right. And then in the center,
is
you have, in the middle, I'd say somewhere around 5 foot tall if you were averaging the world. Somewhere thereabouts.
Okay.
Then you're ending up with, 4 billion?
Right. A lot of people are right in there. How is that logarithmic? In the sense that it really does get smaller.
Right.
As
the first number,
if
you're following that scale of the smallest to largest or largest to smallest, you're going to have a small number of a particular value.
So we're basically talking about like the pattern of nature where a lot of things are similar, and then as it scales away, it becomes different and different. And that is very similar to the logarithmic scale, though we're not correlating directly right now because we're not doing that. But specifically, Benford's law is just talking about if you grab a whole bunch of numbers and you put them together, you'll notice this pattern emerges. And the thing that's very interesting about that is that humans, when they try to create random numbers, don't know about that. So if I say, give me a random, 5-digit number, you're just as likely to start the number with 7 as you are to 1. So if you go into an environment where people are cheating, let's say an accountant is kind of mixing the numbers,
or
an election, they'll make up numbers and put them in there because they want to increase the rate this way or that way. And when they make the number up, they won't use the Benford's law, if you will, to figure out what the first digit will be. So then you analyze all the data sets and you go, hey, look at that. That doesn't fall under this natural logarithmic law of nature. Therefore, somebody was cooking the books. And we saw that in an election. Was it an Iranian election?
No.
I can't remember.
I'm trying to remember what it was. It seems to me it was in Latin America.
But. Yeah, but we've seen this example where the data comes out and then you see, hey, wait a second. There's a lot of sevens in this data set, and that's not really right. Really,
and human beings think of sevens because it's so hard to manipulate. You can't really add and multiply and
divide it. I just picked a bigger digit, and I picked 7, of course.
Right. And so we think of that as being, this is the number that doesn't make sense. This is the random number because 2 is easy to do. 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 7, 14, 21, 28, 35. Oh, okay.
And we're moving on. Yeah, it is a little hard. And, of course, it doesn't have multiple. Right, so nine's a great one we use a lot. Anyway, we'll get on it. The other thing that it has to do with is, that's enough about that interesting law. I just found out about it, really liked it, want to chat about it on the show. But we should go ahead and go on with some more news.
Now all of our listeners will be able to cook the books and forge election results.
That's right, it's really just quite simple to do. You just make sure you
with great power comes great responsibility, audience.
So when people ask for a random digit number, make sure to have 1 about a third of the time as the first digit. All right, let's go on. What's going on with Windows? Mr. Elam?
In Europe, there's been a lot to do with the browser wars.
Mm-hmm.
In the U.S., the Netscape versus IE kind of petered out, kind of fizzled. Netscape died. Internet Explorer became the dominant web browser for many years. And now there are other web browsers like Opera, Safari, Mozilla Suite, things like that that are coming up in the world that are getting more market share.
Mm-hmm.
But the Europeans were actually taking that a bit more seriously and saying, wait a second, if Windows is sold with Internet Explorer, then a lot of people won't realize they have a choice as to which web browser they use. So through a lot of litigation, a lot of wrangling, it looks like in Europe, Windows, when the user first starts up their computer, is going to present a ballot screen.
What do you mean a ballot screen?
A ballot screen that says, which browser would you like to use? You have your choice of Opera or Firefox or Internet Explorer.
Should you list all of them?
Or the major ones, yeah. Mm-hmm. And there was also talk about having it be in randomized order, just so it's not always the first choice or the last choice. And the idea there is you choose which browser you want to use, and then Windows will download it on the fly, and then that's your primary web browser.
And this is a suggestion of whom?
This is the European Union, to say if people want Internet Explorer, they can have Internet Explorer. But if they don't want it, if they want a different browser, and for this...
Well, so what does Windows say about this?
What does Microsoft say?
What does Microsoft say about that? Thank you.
Well, Microsoft was resisting it for a long time. But now it has come to a head where, yes, they're going to have a ballot screen.
Oh, that's great. So that's when you're installing.
Yeah.
When you get your first computer or you get your computer from the store and you can't bring it home, it's going to ask.
You open it up and you say, I want to run
the web browser. So let me ask you this. There are a lot of browsers out there. A lot of people make different browsers. It's a really interesting thing. Flock, for a while, I was talking about. And I'm not using that anymore. But there's a lot of browsers out there that do different things. And we have, you and I can think of the top five, no problem, but there's probably 50. How would you decide if you get in that screen or not? Who's deciding that?
I believe they're talking about it by market share.
Okay. So
there's a certain cutoff point.
The next thing, that means that,
if you have less than a 10% then
you see Google spending all this money on their advertising for Chrome, you would assume that really it would just be about how much you advertise. I mean, that's going to come down. It used to be that it was kind of a discussion about, I would assume it used to be just kind of a discussion about safety and feature set, and that's how we've always talked about it.
If that were the case, would
and
we
have standards.
But if that were the case, would IE have ever become the dominant browser? Because ActiveX has always been a major security.
I guess so. Here's the thing, is giving the people the choice right in the beginning without giving any information about it just means which one has more advertising. That's what it really means, because people generally don't know what technology is better. They just see it and see a price, and then maybe they heard a Geek Speak episode and kind of know something that we've talked about. But in general, people don't necessarily know that this browser is better than this browser because of standards compliance. That doesn't even matter, right? So it really is going to come down to what commercial did they see last.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a better choice than getting this one thing installed everywhere and everyone knowing this browser is really bad and then slowly people migrating away from it?
In the U.S., that's definitely the case. In Europe, you actually have a greater awareness of which browser, which actually brings to a quick little snippet of a story, which is Firefox 3.5 is now the dominant browser if you're talking about Europe.
Really?
It beat Internet Explorer 7, and now I need to look this up. Yeah, Internet Explorer 8 still beats Firefox 3.5, but it beats Internet Explorer 7.
That's nice. That's good. All right. That's a version behind, but that's okay. All right. Well, thank you very much, Miles, for the update on Windows. What is it called again? Ballot screen?
Yeah, it's a ballot screen.
The browser ballot screen. I think it's a good idea. I doubt Apple will do it. All right. So let's Ben, you got something about Google?
Yes, about Google and Etherpad. So
first off,
can
I just say that we're using Etherpad right now, and you can join us. We're not taking calls today, but you could actually chat with us right now. We're like four of you could at least. You could go to etherpad.com/geekspeak, and you'd go into a room where we're chatting. So sorry, Ben, go on.
Yeah, and Etherpad is with an E, not an AE or anything. It's just Etherpad. So we've been using Etherpad a lot
we're having horrible sounds all of a sudden, Ben. Okay, go ahead.
Oh, sorry.
No, it's...
Sorry, I messed... Okay, so, okay.
It's really bad. It's like your microphone or something is wonky. Try again.
Yes, how about now?
No, it's really horrible. It's like your microphone is doing...
I'll hang up and call back.
Okay. Well, we'll go on to the next news story. And I think, Miles, you want to be... No, you just did one. I'm going to do one. Let's see if it works this time. Ben?
Hello.
Hi. Oh, you sound beautiful.
Is this better?
It is.
Oh, much better.
It's delicious.
Fantastic. Delicious. Okay, yeah, so I want to talk about Etherpad. So back on December 5th, we did the holiday float parade thing in Santa Cruz, which was awesome. And I talked a bit about Etherpad because it turns out that Etherpad was bought by Google. And of course, we use Etherpad for setting up our shows, and we also use Etherpad for communicating with our listeners. So again, if any of you want to join us. So it turns out that shortly after I covered it on the show, they re-enabled Etherpad entirely until March, because people, apparently there's a big backlash, because apparently, especially in Sweden, a lot of people use Etherpad for organizations. So, but the big news is that Google recently has open sourced Etherpad and released all of the source code under the Apache license, which is really fantastic. Woo-hoo. Exactly. So, you know, maybe we could set it up on our website or something. But so the Swedish Pirate Party grabbed it and launched their own instance of Etherpad at piratepad.net. So you can go and create Etherpads at piratepad.net. And then there's also, there are a couple other ones. There's Uxo, U-X-O-O, is a new service. And it looks like they're actually going to try to take the Etherpad code and add to it and make it even better than it already is. So.
Awesome. Thank you. So Etherpad, again, is a real-time collaboration tool online. You have a text document in front of you. You can type into it. Everything you type kind of highlights in the color. And then other people who joins you can also type at the same time. And it's kind of like, it's kind of mind-boggling that it works so well. And we use it every week on the show to inform us that the next thing that Miles is going to say, for example, is he's going to talk about the science of Santa. And now, Miles, we have a lot of kids in the room and across the nation listening to Geek Speak. So what up about the science of Santa? Or do you want to
actually
skip that
one? I think I'll just post that up on the website. Okay. It's an interesting read. It talks about the fact that Santa Claus would need to have some information that we don't necessarily have right now, but it's kind of in theoretical physics land. So probably either a time traveler from the 23rd century going back and playing around there, or an alien.
Okay. Good to know. Well, you can read that about up on geekspeak.org.
One quick selection. Yeah. The ballot screen, have a user letting us know this. Thank you, Jeremy. That the ballot screen is not for downloading the browser. It's for selecting the default browser in use.
Okay.
So
you download all of them?
They're already bundled on the disk, and then you click and it selects the default one. So if you click on a link in Office or you know, some other application, that it will launch that browser instead of Internet Explorer.
Yeah. What's that, Ben? What's that little app in Macintosh environment where you can get a browser choosing device, or basically the default browser type is this kind of pseudo application, which then forwards off your defaults to different browsers?
Are you talking about site-specific browsers, Fluid?
No, Fluid's the site-specific browser that we've talked about before, but the basic idea is you make an application called a Fluid application, which is called, for example, Gmail. And then when you're in Gmail, you're only in the application, and when it crashes, it's only Gmail that crashes, even though it's a browser application. What I'm talking about is this switching thing, which basically your default browser is this little application, and the application looks at the incoming URL and says, hey, this is a Gmail URL, and it forwards it off to that Fluid installation, for example. Or
I don't think I was talking to you about that. That sounds awesome.
You should look it up. Okay, let's go on with a story that was in the New York Times. Maybe it's just the blog Times. Stephen Lohr wrote it. Nerd and geek should be banned, professor says. And he's basically talking about that the term nerd has been derogatory and geek has been derogatory. Now, Miles and I have been doing Geek Speak for almost 10 years now. Geek Speak's been off air for 11 years, and we don't think it was derogatory. I'm proud of my geek moniker. Miles, you?
Yeah, and I mean, sticks and stones may break my bones, but names would never hurt me.
Oh, there's names that would hurt you. But we jokingly, of course, call each other nerds sometimes when we get too geeky. So there is a bit of a dichotomy there, I would say, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, and on the East Coast, nerd is actually the affectionate term, like geek is here, and geek is the derogatory term on the East Coast. So
now, David Anderberg, he's a professor of psychology at Burlington College, says that merely mentioning terms like nerd and geek serves to perpetuate the stereotype. And see, I think he's coming from a place of seeing college kids, undergrad students, deciding what classes they'll take to some degree from peer pressure. And that's, of course, the issue, right? If you're going to take that science class or not, and it really comes down to whether the kids around you are going to call you a name that you don't want to be called, you've got a problem. Is that right? Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah. But
now, he says this is the solution. He says the best way to combat this, he said, is put it to bed, banning nerd and geek to the linguistic dustbin. Is it possible to change language by just mandating the change of language?
One, it's not possible to mandate it. And second, if you get rid of that, if someone has the impulse to be derogatory in a certain way to someone, you know, you're going to just replace it with some other in the lexicon. This is the same thing that happens with profanity. We're not allowed to say certain words on air, certain words that I won't even give as an example.
But there are seven of them at least.
Right, but...
Look up George Carlin's seven deadly words, or seven words George Carlin on YouTube. Yeah. It's a great bit.
So,
not for kids.
But at the same time, you end up with people getting around that. So you have Battlestar Galactica making up terms like frack and felderkarp.
Right.
Yeah. So it's not so much that you've stopped the use of the word. You've just changed the word that you use to demonstrate the concept. Because
right.
the concept
the meaning
won't
is still
go
the same.
Away.
Right. And that's the issue, that you can't just say, well, nerd's a damaging word and offensive, and therefore stop using it, because then someone will come up with a term like geek, for example. I mean, that's a bad example. But the thing that I wanted to mention about this is that I've embraced geek as a name for a long time. I proudly wear it. Now, my niece, she thinks of it as a geeky term, but of course that's because her older uncle has got that radio show, which is silly. Mm-hmm. And so from that perspective, there is some dogma around it. But I personally think it's a great term. And the big reason is that this is crazy optimistic perspective I have, that I think everybody's kind of getting more and more technically savvy. That's kind of how I feel about it. And that idea of the geek or the nerd being kind of the cutting edge of that to some degree is compelling to people, you know?
And there is something to say about taking ownership of it, much the same way as queer was just something a little bit odd, and then queer became a derogatory term for someone who was homosexual, and then it became someone took ownership of it.
Right.
So like, no, we are queer, you know, that type of thing.
Right.
And so we are geek. That
fixes it?
Yeah. Well, it doesn't fix it, but I mean, it means you're not running from it.
Right. And this article also, I always love to talk about the difference between nerd and geek, because people ask me all the time. And this article talks about the term cool nerd. But anyway, the cognitions are a bit different. A geek suggests a person with special expertise, while a nerd suggests social impotence. And neither are cool is the idea behind this.
On
professor.
The West Coast, that's true.
And
on
that's
the
on East
West Coast, that switches over.
And even though this is the New York Times writing it, so maybe it's become more generified. I don't know.
Maybe they just listened to our show and the guy didn't know any better.
All right, moving on. Whose turn is it? I think it's Miles' turn.
Oh, my turn. Okay, so let's talk about the transistor.
I love the transistor.
Yeah, 62 years ago, Bell Labs, first functional transistor. You know, really pushed technology forward before we were using vacuum tubes. Mm-hmm. Transistors made things a lot smaller, a lot cooler, a lot faster. Well, researchers recently have showed the first functional transistor made from a single molecule.
How does that, what molecule?
A benzene molecule attached to gold contacts could behave just like a silicon transistor, according to these researchers.
Wait a second. I mean, what about like quantum problems at that level? I mean, that's small.
Well,
you don't have stability. Like, you don't have like normal ideas of matter at that
we'll
point.
We'll see how things work out, but the thing is, we need to get smaller if we want to have computers go faster, because that's really what drives our...
The more brain implants, the smaller we need, is basically what you're saying. If you want to be able to inject into your brain the ability to fly a helicopter in a few seconds, you've really got to get small transistors. That's the rule.
But if you're reducing transistors to that size, you have CPUs that are much smaller, much cooler... require much less
power. A benzene
molecule
must be really big. I mean, how do you connect gold plates to a molecule? That doesn't even make any sense. I mean, that becomes a new molecule. You're not connecting it. You're
attaching a gold atom.
Yeah. Now it's a new molecule. Wait, so the new molecule will be called transistium or something? That's pretty cool. All right, one molecule transistors plus some gold on the side.
Yeah, and you know what? I'm sure there are a whole bunch of nerds responsible for doing this.
And we love them for it.
Yes. I hope they had a wonderful holiday season and
get back to work.
And, you know, I hope that they are, like many nerds actually, as they go through life, very successful and very fulfilled in their life.
What is that? What was that? Are you alone or lonely lately? What's going on?
No. I mean, I'm talking about in high school. That's the big stereotype, is that you're not as cool as the jocks. You're not, you know... You might get bullied a little bit.
Hey, why are you bringing back this pain, Miles? Why? All right.
But just so you know, when you get out of high school, all you geeks and nerds, you get to rule the world.
That's right. It's true. The nerd, the geek inherit the earth. Is that what it is?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Ben, you've got quite a few more stories. You've got like 5 more stories, and I don't know which one's going to be awesome, so I'm going to let you pick whatever one you want.
I will just cover the next one, which is the Unidentified Aerospace Phenomena 2009 Observations Reporting Scheme. And that is a project, and it says on their website, it's a project that basically... So you go outside and you see at night, you see some unidentified object which appears to be flying, right? And so you say, oh, UFO. And, you know, in our society, UFO means alien. And so you say, I saw an alien. And then people think you're crazy, right? Well, it turns out that actually just this year, they initiated this project, this program. And it's a website, uapreporting.org. And you can go there if you see something unusual or strange or unidentified in the sky. And the idea is that this project would fix a couple problems. First of all, a lot of people that see things in the sky that they can't immediately identify, they don't report them because they worry that they'll be mocked or they'll be thought to be crazy, you know, like a lot of other people also will report things, but they won't just speculate maybe on what they were or say, I don't know, but they'll claim, oh, I'm sure it was a saucer. I'm sure because it was moving in this way and I'm positive of this, you know. But I mean, there are a lot of people out there who mistake the moon for a flying saucer, you know, I mean, under certain atmospheric conditions and everything. So hopefully to fix that problem as well. And also to engage and stimulate the public and foster awareness for the sky and for the phenomena that are in the sky. So I guess those are the goals of this project. So if you're ever outside and you see something really unusual or something you can't immediately identify, you can go ahead and submit a report there. And you can also submit images or video if you took any video or anything.
And don't try to identify it, right? Just try to be a really good, clean observer. See it. Try to think of everything you know about it that's really what you know. Like, you don't necessarily know how far up it is, right? But you know how fast you think it was traveling, stuff like that. And go ahead and report what you can. But try to be – like, it's doing that from a scientific perspective where you're trying to get rid of your bias. It's really interesting
Right. I want to draw upon Carl Sagan when he talked about UFOs, which was someone would say actually Neil deGrasse Tyson talked about this as well. Let's say you see something, you're like, hey, that's, I don't know what that is. It's a UFO.
It is a UFO.
It's aliens. Now, you've already made a contradictory statement. I don't know what that is. It must be aliens. But if it's aliens, it means you know what it is, which is contradicting your earlier statement of I'm not sure what that is.
So pick one and choose and stick with it.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, it sounds like confirmation bias. Yeah.
And also people, and that goes for all humans, have so much confidence in their senses, which is really, I don't think, deserved. I mean, we really have, we're really bad at observing things, especially in conditions like if it's really dark and you don't have any frame of reference, then how on earth can you really say, oh, I'm sure that it was about this far away, this high up and moving this fast, you know, like there are no reference frames. The other thing that this website offers is it gives you a lot of information about different misidentifications that are that happen often. Like it'll talk about stars and planets and upper atmosphere lightning and satellites and rocket launches and all these different things, and how you can kind of tell, you know, like what are the telltale signs that maybe what you saw was some kind of rocket launch or a satellite reentry.
Oh, cool.
Or something.
So it kind of talks about how you can identify stuff in the sky. Very cool.
And so even if you haven't seen aliens, you know, you could go and read about all of these things. It's really an interesting read. So
cool. Thank you very much. Jeremy on our Etherpad space mentions that the choosing your browser by the URL, the thing for OS 10 is called Choosy OS 10. And there's a link up on the website currently on geekspeak.org. We have a lot of the stuff we talk about during the show we put up on geekspeak.org. So feel free to go up there and explore. And of course, you can send us questions and such as well. Miles, you've got one more story because we are running, you know, we're really short on time. I don't even know if I've got a story for you, but, you know.
Let's see here.
I'm feeling like 2 minutes and counting, not enough time.
Yeah.
I've got a really quick one.
Go for it. Really fast.
All right. So there is a proposal which is about to be submitted to NASA. These scientists want to try to put a boat of sorts, down on a sea of one of Saturn's moons, Titan. And the sea is actually made of liquid methane. So the idea is that they're going to build this little ship that's going to float on the sea of liquid methane. Really cool idea. I kind of hope this goes through just so we can see the video footage of it or the images of this, you know?
Thank you very much, Ben. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used by permission. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP Santa Cruz. We're streaming and podcasting at KUSP.org. The geeks this morning were Miles Elam and Ben Jaffe. My name is Lyle Troxell. You can ask us questions throughout the week and give us suggestions for the show. You can record audio and send us email to those audio files if you'd like to ask us questions and you are only a podcast listener and not a live listener. We're here to serve you every week. Coming up next is, of course, Car Talk. This is Lyle Troxell, and I will see you next week. Thanks for tuning in.